We have topics. I even came up with some.
We not only do we have topics, but we have a guest.
We have topics and a guest. This is like a squirrel copia.
I don't know what's going on. Actually, I do know what's going on. It's the new score report.
It is. All this quality entertainment for free, I'd like to remind people.
We made a commitment to actually prepare ahead of time.
Crazy talk. It'll never last. It'll kill us all.
Yeah, yeah, we've done this before. You know, 5 minutes before, like, sending you know, hurried emails. What do you want to talk about? Oh my God, what's on Drudge? Yeah. We'll see how it goes. I just want to remind everybody that, you know, this is a free show. None of us get paid. We all do this out of our own time. And,
it actually costs money to do this.
It costs Alan money to do the show.
It costs Alan money. If you feel like sending someone a wheelbarrow of money, send it to Alan.
Yeah, send it to Alan. And, you know, if you have complaints about the new show, you are more than welcome to not listen. Because
we will refund 150% of your purchase price.
Yeah. Send a self-addressed stamped envelope.
Exactly. We will happily refund everything you paid for the show.
Right.
Because that's how these squirrels roll, baby.
But we do appreciate the people who have stuck with us and through all of our incarnations, you know, from our call-in show to our not call-in show to our topic show to our not topics, and then now this. So
whatever the hell we do.
Yeah, this is like our second pivot now. To use the Silicon Valley speak.
Yeah.
Is this like a pivot table?
No, it is not. It's not a pivot table. In Silicon Valley speak, a pivot is when you launch a company to do something and you get in a lot of money and you suddenly realize at some point that that thing you wanted to do is either impossible or impractical or way too expensive. And so you go, well, shit, we got a whole bunch of money. We could either give it back to the investors or we could do something else. And that's called a pivot.
So you're saying we don't have to give all that money back to the investors?
No.
I watch Silicon Valley, so I know all about it.
Well, you're an expert. Well, at least you didn't watch. What is the show that makes you a political expert?
Suddenly? House of Cards.
You didn't watch House of Cards and become a political expert, like some children did.
Brita had that kid. She's like, bless your heart.
Yeah, that kid.
Like, I think that was the perfect application of bless your heart.
Yeah, it was.
It's interesting how
it's going, because he keeps like digging the hole a little bit deeper, this kid, this David Hogg.
More and more people are realizing this kid is just hogging the limelight. He's got his 15 minutes and he's milking it for all it's worth. And he's kind of standing on the bodies of his dead classmates to do it. And that's kind of sick.
Yeah.
Also, they keep calling him a survivor, which is nonsensical. He didn't survive anything. He was just in the area when it happened.
Yeah.
It's not like he got shot.
By that logic, I'm a Boston Marathon bombing survivor.
There you go. You were in the area.
That's right. Alan, you're a Houston flood survivor.
I am.
Rita is a mistake on the lake survivor.
Was I alive even? Oh, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter.
It's Cleveland. Right. You survived proximity to Cleveland.
Gotta be tough.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
The spokespeople they've chosen have not even been, you know, it's not like they were in the same room.
Right. It may not even been in the same building. I don't know. But regardless, they're not survivors in the sense that we think of people as being survivors. They are, you know, I don't know what they are. Attention whores.
Yep.
Speaking of attention whores.
Oh, yes, I'm right here.
I was going to introduce our guest, who is not an attention whore. In fact, he's the opposite. He's the opposite of an attention whore. He is the international man of mystery, Matthew Allen.
Right. Hello.
Famed cyborg hunter, Matthew Allen.
Matthew, right off the bat, what caliber for Uber self-driving vehicle?
You know, I think at this point, like, it's going to have to be like one of the 50 calibers, because, you know, though it's a modern car, so you can probably put it down with a 380 because it's all, you know, plastic. But you know, more is less, or less is more.
Wait a minute. If they're all plastic, shouldn't you have to use a Glock?
Okay, and I'm off the air.
But I'm bummed.
I said the killing.
You know, I actually have a Glock in my house now. It's only for the night, though.
It's my fault, isn't it?
It is. It is your fault.
How did this happen? I am curious. How did Jade talk you into this, or?
Because you want to take it?
I drove a dump truck full of money up to his house. He's not made of stone.
And he said, "What price would you sell out at?" And I was like, "Well, okay."
Are you okay?
Blink
twice,
right? I'm a mercenary. I'm a mercenary at the end of the day. I mean, yeah. So yeah, he. It would make for a good photo opportunity and good. So I had to scrounge around and borrow a couple of Glocks that matched. So
Matthew had an excellent idea for an article for the website that I happen to manage. So
yes. And so I've been running around the house for like the last three days, dry firing a Glock 43 or two of them, sometimes akimbo, just because, you know, you should.
Do you make the pew pew noise? I have to know.
It's more of a
factory trigger.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Factory trigger.
I thought you were going for the old 8-bit gunfire sound from.
Does your dog laugh at you when you miss the duck?
Yeah. She's more of an eye roll dog. So.
We don't normally introduce ourselves because we figure you know who we are, don't care. But I think we do need to introduce our guest and say a little bit about what he does. And
what do you do, Matthew?
Man, that's a good question on any given day.
Okay.
Because I get it in technically, like under licensure, I fall into the realm of private investigator.
Archer.
You know what's funny about Archer is, and I can't say his name because I'm not supposed to talk about him. If you take out the whole spy thing and you just take out and you just look at all the degenerate parts of Archer, he was the guy I bodyguarded for years.
Oh my God!
And that's not. I mean, even the hair, and his views on alcohol and firearms at the same time was just. Yeah.
Was he always firing it indoors and going? Meep, meep,
oh no, no, no! Sometimes we were driving down the road and he would shoot it out the window. So that, in fact, that was my very first night on that job.
So you bodyguarded Elvis?
Yeah. It's funny because we were on a boat one time going over to the Bahamas and it's just all sorts of debauchery and chaos going on this boat in the middle of the night. And one of the executive assistants I was kind of standing on the bridge and we're looking and he goes, "Did you ever see that movie, The Last Days of Elvis?" And so,
you're basically currently a private investigator, but you kind of got involved in this from an early age.
I did, yeah. And so I always tell people that I solve problems, and that was actually in high school. You know, your senior year, and they're asking you what are you going to do, and blah blah blah. And a teacher said, she goes, what are you really going to do? Because I had always made jokes about what I was going to do.
Wait a minute. Wait a second. Are you telling me you're Vanilla Ice? Because if you got a problem,
yo, I solve it.
I'm sorry. Oh, boy.
Yeah, I just don't, you know, didn't have those beautiful blonde hair like he did, so. Or those bibs. So the teacher said, she goes, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "You know, I'm going to solve people's problems, and they're going to pay me for it." And she was like, "No one's ever going to do that." And I was like, "You just watch."
And, And now you have a swanky office too.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's very bizarre to be completely legitimate.
You're kind of like the guy from Burn Notice.
Yeah, you know what? I
solving problems.
Yes, and there's a couple of episodes. So I have theories on Burn Notice because I think part of Burn Notice ripped me off.
Oh shit!
Okay.
Yeah, like they legitimately. Because there's a couple of scenes in very early episodes on that show, and I'm like, did I briefly dated a girl who was a reporter for, I don't remember now, somewhere on the East Coast. Well, she was trying to do a story, and we hooked up, and so I was telling some work stories, and then I was like. Later on, everyone was talking about the show Burn Notice, and I watched the first couple of episodes. I'm like, huh. and there's one episode, and I can't remember what it was, but it was, I mean, some of the things were just spot on spooky. But I was like, of course, in the course of doing things in life, you know, there's a lot of guys who do these sort of things. And so I'm like, yeah, I can see where some of this could roll over to be anybody. But there was a couple of episodes, I'm like, Ray Donovan's we joke in business partner and I joke all the time that Ray Donovan is actually a really good betrayal of things sometimes, you know. But yeah, because I've always said I was a private consultant. In 2010, the state passed licensure, which I was against for years and years and years. They finally got it forced through. And it was basically nothing more than guys trying to put other guys out of business. That was the whole plan.
Sure.
That's how it always is.
And that's all that it was. And I know that because in the 90s when I first started, I worked for a firm. And they were part of this PI council kind of thing. And they talked about how that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to put the one-man shops out of business.
Do they do that through the state? Like you have to qualify with your state, you have to take classes or pass.
Oh yeah,
or...
I have to take continuing education. Uh-huh. Like I've been doing this for 20 years, and I got to take and they're terrible classes and terrible courses. I mean, you can kind of submit whatever. I've thrown things in there that I've gone to seminars and stuff, like mental health seminars and things like that, and thrown in there, and they usually take it. But I'm like, it's a racket.
It is a racket, sure.
And what made everybody mad was like the first 4 or 5 years, they would send you your ID and you would take it out of your wallet and all the ink had come off.
Oh, no.
I mean, like, so I actually kind of liked it because I was like, there's nothing on the card, but I'm in possession of my license. So I was like, this is awesome. And so then there was a big protest. And these guys were like, we're not paying until this is fixed. I'm like, why don't we just get away with everything? I'm actually talking to a couple of state reps. I'm like, what would this take to make this all go away? So,
money.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So,
if only someone could find dirt on these reps.
Well, you know what's so interesting is because now we're doing a lot of the political opposition research work, and I'm just continually amazed how stupid Democrats are. I mean, like, you would think at some point you're like, okay, they just make bad life choices. No, these people are stupid. Like, you have conversations with them. I'm like, huh, I should run for office. And I think that's what happens. I think that's how other people run for office, is they have conversations with these people. Well, and yeah, it's amazing how much infighting there is.
I think I read something that getting back to what I said, you were kind of got into this at an early age.
Oh yeah.
Weren't you involved in like solving like a murder?
I did.
When you were like basically a kid.
Yeah. I was like 15 when it happened, or 15 or 16. I was about to either turn 15 or 16. Her name was Shay Sims, and she had been brutally raped and murdered in my area. Where I grew up at. And, it was a big deal. I mean, like it major case squad was called in. They had found her raped and mutilated in a creek bed. And she was like 12. And yeah. And so it was like she was found behind in a creek bed behind a grocery store. My mom used to go to that grocery store and things like that. And so they started putting out stuff about the killers and things like they cut. There was a they put out in the newspaper that she had cuts on her arms, and they thought maybe the killers in an attempt of immaturity to revive her had cut her, kind of a thing. And later we come out that they made a blood pack over it and made a ritual cut. And but so they started putting out these police sketches, composites. And of the one I was like looking at, I know this dude. I just know him. And so like I literally obsessed over it for about 3 or 4 days and was like trying to sketch his face. And I was coming back to the whole knife thing. And eventually it kind of clicked in my head, because in that area, like literally within about about a quarter of a mile area, there was these four guys that used to run around together that I knew from junior high, and they all carry like the Buck 110 folders that are, you know, in the sheaths on their belts, and it was kind of going out of vogue at the time. And but I remember they carried those, and it turns out, yeah, it's funny because I had mine on over the weekend. Mine was a straight. I didn't want to buck up the extra $10 because I was cheap, and so they I thought of that, and I ended up matching him with an old yearbook photo to that, and they called in like two homicide detectives, came into my school and interviewed me. And about 3 days later, they arrested him, or at some point later they arrested him. And then the older, and he was like about 15, well, he and I were the same age, so he was 14 or 15. And then I think after they arrested him, it started breaking down really quickly. And then there was three other guys who were not the first three guys. The other three guys I was talking about with the buck knives. There was like a 20-year-old involved in it. And yeah, like that guy, he's doing life in prison. They convicted him. Yeah. So that was literally my first case. And, you know, it's interesting because at the time I literally wrote I was making a profile of him and didn't even realize it. And then, 2 weeks out of high school, a cousin of mine asked me to investigate something. Like Larry said, he goes, "I want to pay you a retainer of $200. And I want you." Right. You know, and I was like, "Well, I'm on the way." And I was working for my old man at the time, because he had a metal finishing business down the city. And I was like, "Look, I've got a case. So, you know, I'm not going to be in for a couple of weeks." And, you know, my old man was like, "Well, yeah, you need to be at work." And I'm like, "Well, he's paying me what you pay me." So, so I was able to kind of jockey out for a couple of weeks on that. And it was, he thought it was a fraud deal. And what was funny is I walked into the St. Louis County Police Office and I was like, you know, "What does it take to become a private investigator?" And again, this is early 90s, and cops like, "There is no licensure." I was completely dumbfounded by this. I was like, "Seriously, what does it take?" And he made the sign of the cross. He goes, "You are now a private investigator." Oh, wow. And so I had been ordained. Blessed by the cops. So, and then like after that, a couple years later, I was dating a girl and she had a friend. She had gotten pregnant by this guy and she wanted to know if he was working. So then I ran my surveillance. Well, I ran a surveillance. It wasn't my first surveillance, because I think I ran my first surveillance off my bike, when I was 11. It's funny, because I actually did my first – I wore a wire when I was in the seventh grade. We had some substitute teacher, and we came back, and I think the dude was high. I didn't realize it at the time. And we came back and he was like going on this deranged, like he was screaming and cussing and telling everybody how the political system is rigged, and he's dropping the F bomb, and you're all these 12-year-olds are like, "What?" And I reached in my jean jacket, my Levi jean jacket, and hit my microset tape recorder and started recording the whole thing. So I got like this great 35-minute rant, and they fired him. So. So the dive,
the fan,
Eddie. Yeah. So
Matthew Allen.
Yeah.
So how do you go about? I mean, you started out kind of, you know, "Hey, I'm going to go do this thing," but
yeah,
you have to learn a certain skill set to get to where you are today, and it's not like you can go to, or can you go to private investigator school? I don't know.
Well, they do, and now they offer courses. It, funny enough, how it kind of the ball got rolling for me. is there was a guy at the mall who had a kiosk who sold like security stuff. And this is a long
story. I mean, like the camera in a pen type thing?
No, like he sold like stun guns and extendable batons and that sort of thing. And like it was like, and he was the guy who would dress like in black Levi's and black jeans and, you know, and had like, you know, he was an older guy. And I ended up having this conversation with him. I bought one of these extendable batons and, you know, I was going to do what I was going to do in life, but had no clue how to get there. And so I started asking him about, you know, I said, well, I was kind of interested in being a bodyguard. And he was like, well, you should go to bodyguard school. I was like, they have bodyguard school. And so he literally, he pulled out like two different names of two different, you know, schools. And one was in Virginia, Executive Protection Institute. The other one was, I can't remember what the other one was. I didn't go to that one. That was in Colorado. And, yeah, I ended up going to, the Executive Protection Institute for a couple of weeks. Actually, the first time I went, I got my ankle broke. And, ooh. Oh yeah, like it was, got there on Sunday and by Tuesday my ankle was broke. And I got it broke by a Special Forces Army Ranger who was going through the class. And it was interesting because the wall had, you know, come down a few years earlier. So you had most of the instructors were like the old man who ran the school was an ex-Chicago police detective, but he had been an Interpol cop and he had worked over in Europe and everything else. In fact, he'd got involved in a bank robbery shootout over in Born, Germany, I think. And, like he and his wife and his partner and his wife, they were walking on the street and literally stumbled into a bank robbery. These guys come pouring out of the bank and they're walking down the street. So they engage these guys in a gunfight. And, but then some of the instructors were like ex Secret Service, ex CIA, ex DIA. And there was just a whole myriad of people. So somewhere on, I'm going to school. I'm thrilled to be there. I'm like 21 years old and completely excited. And all these other guys are, you know, in their 40s and 50s, and they've been through more training and military and everything else. They could care less to be there because the boss sent them. And so I was supposed to be the assassin on one of these. They were going to do a press the flesh kind of deal. And so in my brain, I was going to be real slick and smooth, and I was just going to walk up and act like I was shaking his hand and, you know, the fake protectee and they had like, they were running a diamond formation with about five guys protecting him as he walked through. So I was going to be real cool and casual about this. And the next thing I know, my feet just started running. I have no idea why. And, so I'm making this full body run. Like, that was exactly what it was too. And the next thing I know, I caught an elbow across the throat and this ranger takes me down like hard. And he's got me in a headlock, and he landed on me, and I landed on my ankle that was behind my back.
Oh.
And I was like, I think my ankle's broke. And then he gets off me. I was like, I think it's okay. I think I can walk on it. And yeah. And then
nope.
And then I dislocated it. And so I'm looking down my leg, and my foot's like way over on the other side in the air. Oh. Yeah.
So it hurts just thinking about it.
Oh, yeah. That was terrible. And I started sweating. I'd never been in shock before, and I started going into shock. And apparently, I started babbling something, and somebody threw a blanket on me. And the old man, the instructor, comes out and goes, "This is a good time for triage treatment. Who's a medical expert?" So, yeah. So they used it as a training exercise as well. It was
convenient.
Yeah, it was very convenient, you know. And so, so I actually went back later, and after I healed up and. And then I came back, and after that was all through, I started putting out resumes, and almost went down to Florida to work. And then I can't remember what the name's totally escaped me, but it was like it was kind of not the Rothschilds, but it was like somebody like the Rothschilds had some big estate up in the Northeast, and they were looking for a full time guy to guard the estate, live there when nobody was there, and. I didn't get that, and I ended up working for a local firm for a couple of years till I got subcontracted out to do the executive protection stuff for the corporate job.
So hold on a second. There was a wealthy family in the Northeast looking for a caretaker when no one's around. You auditioned for The Shining, is what you're telling us.
it was like you were supposed to be in there in the winter months and stuff like that, and I had gone through a couple of interviews with the guy who was like their liaison person, and And it was like 300 or 400 acres. It was a huge spread. And I don't know if it killed it or what, but it, he was like, you know, is there any questions you'd like to ask me? I was like, well, do they have a target range? And, cause you know, I'm thinking, I was like, well, I'm going to pack up all my hand loads. I'm going to go, you know, in the winter time, I'm going to, you know, go shoot through the winter. Yeah. I never got called back after that. So chalk it up to Northeast liberalism is the best thing I could figure. So,
yeah, they didn't want someone capable of doing the job. They wanted someone
no.
questions.
Right. Well, you know, not, and you know, I was fully ready to go. I was going to be outfitted with my lever action rifle. So, you know, that was my tactical equipment at the time. So
we should probably talk about that. How you in a world of Glocks and AR-15s, you're kind of known to be the wheel gun guy and the lever action guy. You have multiple pictures of all, you know, your revolvers and your rifles, and it looks, I mean, it's unique in this day and age. You know it what
might
I mean?
Even, quaint might be a better term.
It is quaint.
It is interesting, Brita. That's a good point.
But it is quaint, but there is also, you know, if something works, why fix it kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to know, like, what drives you to, you know, be different in a world of, you know, Glocks and ARs. And
I think a lot of it has, especially at the lever action rifles perspective, that came about really more for two reasons. Was that maybe three? Is that the lever gun was always so practical, but I also came up at a time after the 94 assault weapons ban was passed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I bought a Mini 14, and the thing was like minute of man at 100 yards.
Notorious.
And you know, oh yeah, I liked everything but the barrel on that gun. And and meanwhile, you know, two of my lever actions, I would shoot, you know, 1 inch or 1.5 inch groups. And so it was more practical. And I think people, especially now, we tend to forget how anti-gun the 80s and the 90s were. And so there was a lot of bad perception, and no one had AR-15s. And if you did, they were $1,000 back then. And,
yep.
You know, and you would see maybe at the rifle range, you'd see a guy with an AR, and you would stop and like, oh, he's got an AR. And, I had picked up at the time a lever action Marlin 44 Magnum from a truck driver out at the range for $100. He's like, yeah, some guy gave it to me to pay off a debt. And he goes, I've never shot it. So I went the next day and bought it from him for $100. And it was this perfect size carbine. It was thin. And I was like, you know, inside the United States, I doubt I ever have to use a rifle in a gunfight. And if I do, you know, I knew how to shoot. And I practiced with it religiously. And I was like, if I'm not getting this done in, you know, 7 to 8 rounds, I'm going to have a bigger problem. And a lot of the guys that I had worked with or I trained with and things like that were all old timers and had been in, you know, real legit gunfights. And no one ever seemed to really care about capacity. And at that point, I started, you know, I was carrying either a revolver or a 1911. And so again, with the assault weapons ban, you were kind of limited to 10 rounds. And so it just kind of held on. And I just never really kind of went on beyond that. I guess I kind of got stuck in time to a certain degree. And I did carry a 9 for a while. I actually had a very early car, when the car pistol came out, I thought that was going to be a real slick package because I didn't like the Glocks at all. I could shoot Glocks really well. That's kind of the damnable thing about it. But I picked up a car E9. It wasn't even a K9. It was the economy version. And so I carried that for a couple of years and I liked the gun. I had an instance where the 9mm kind of left me cold after an experience. I was less than impressed. And I think some of it was, you know, and it wasn't, you know, everyone's like, oh, with modern ammunition. And I'm like, well, I'm shooting 115 grain Corbin plus P. And it was, I don't know, I think it was a gold dot load at the time. And so it just kind of left me with less than stellar. It's a funny story that I can't tell on the air, but
But trust him. It's funny.
Oh, yeah, but trust me. It's funny. It's because I've been in gunfights, and then I've been in I always say I've been in a number of gunfights, and I've been in one shooting, and so there's a difference.
Right.
Yeah. Because yeah.
Say no more.
That's right. So after that, I was, you know, I kind of went back to the big bullet theory and slow and heavy. Hmm. And but yeah, I think it more of it's just practicality, and I also think there's always that perception that's going to happen because, you know, especially now, you know, we've always said how every bullet comes with an attorney attached to it. Well, now it comes with national and international scrutiny attached to it.
Right.
And I always figured, especially when I was doing protection work with the lever gun, that if I ever had to use it, it was going to be in a roadside situation, that it was because the car got disabled and literally I was shooting it out on the side of the road. And at some point, I always had in my mind there was going to be this overshot of a helicopter with, you know, the gun laying on the hood of the car, and it was kind of a two position piece. One, if it ever went to court, if I did something bad or it got called into question. Again, this is the early 90s, and so I wanted them to have to, you know, look at this lever action rifle. And then there was in the back of my mind too, I wanted to be the guy that got it done with a lever action rifle. So, so there was a little, you know, hubris in there too.
That's goals, people. Goals. Well,
you know, that's the point. You know, more than anything, you know, it's like, you know, the average guy walking down the street with a concealed carry permit. You know, it'd be like winning the lottery if you had to draw your gun and use it on something.
Oh, absolutely. That's right.
That's the odds. I mean, it's very, but then, you know, on the other hand, if you're a cop, you know,
right,
it's pretty likely. And I have to think that if you're, you know, in your line of work, that it's somewhere in the middle, you know, it's not as likely as a cop because you're not actually arresting criminals.
No, yet. But I pulled my, yeah.
Yeah, right. At the same time.
Well, and it's funny because I was telling, they always used to say that in my line of work, well, especially when you're doing executive protection, if you've had to pull your gun, everything's gone wrong. And things must have just gone wrong enough times for me because I'm like, yeah, there was plenty of times I had to pull my gun. And in fact, I had an armed confrontation 2 weeks ago, and that was a very, I realize now I'm getting older and this is the, cause literally I came back and I was like, yeah, maybe time to start writing.
Yes.
The funny thing about that was that whole situation was kind of the antithesis of the lever action rifle because I had to go out of state and there was gangbangers involved and there was drugs involved. And so it was kind of a two part plan. The client who was not stable, there was a secondary portion where he was supposed to go into Florida and my business partner was supposed to link up with him and I was going to kind of stay behind and take care of things. After he left, he's like, oh, by the way, cause I was going to have to go in and kind of sweep and clean the house out of property. And because we wanted to kind of dot some I's and cross some T's he said, you know, just so you know, he goes, because I'm gone now, there could be, you know, three or four drug heads in there. And I'm like, well, that's good to know. And kind of knowing that ahead of time, and I've been packing this, this 686 357, and I always pack, I always carry two guns, and then usually if I'm traveling, it's always three. And as I left to go on that trip, I went in and I grabbed my 30-30 and I was like, I looked over and I saw my Zastava AK pistol and I thought, this might be that trip. And wow.
I believe you're required to call it a Draco or a Choppa.
Oh yeah. The Choppa. Yeah. And so that's my one guilty tactical gun. So I packed it and everything was fine after I went through the house and cleared the house and But then when I came out, I had three gentlemen who wanted to speak with me. And they were very interested as they got out of the car. One of them, as he made sure to open up his jacket so he could show me what he had. And he goes, well, me and Mr. Glock. And I said, well, you and Mr. High Point. and I said, I'll do you one better. And because the porch was kind of, there was like a wall around the porch. And so, you know, apparently my AK pistol spoke to, you know, was bilingual because everybody understood. So
get to the chopper.
Get to the chopper, exactly. And it was funny because I had staged it. I had walked out there. I was like, what a smart thing to leave it on the porch. But if I have to walk out, I saw a car drive by and I was like, I think these gentlemen are here to see me. And so I walked outside and stuck it on the porch, kind of in a spot, and saw them pull up and come walking up the street. And so I walked out and drinking my coffee and talking to them, and we're exchanging pleasantries. And I went to set my coffee down, and that's when I reached up and pulled the Zastava, and everybody came to a brief understanding that I was going to stay where I was, and they were not going to stay where I was. So, yeah. You know, I love the lever action. I love the wheel guns. I love the 1911s. But it always makes me a little bit bitter because when you say you like those things, people somehow think that you're anti-gun or you're anti, you know, high capacity or whatever. And I'm like, no, not at all. You know. Yeah.
It is possible to love two things.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting until. Because I didn't have an AR till maybe 2-3 years ago. I just the platform. I just never cared for the platform. And
you and Breida.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you what made me buy the AR more than anything was when Ferguson happened. Ferguson is not as the crow flies is 7 miles from my house. And watched all that unfold, and you know that was actually kind of a two-part story because that kind of came back around, and we were actually out. My business partner and I were actually taking a client to a therapist meeting where they were protesting in kind of the county hub, the county seat, and we had to take her to this therapist, and so he was driving, and I was literally riding shotgun because I had my 870 parked next to me in the seat, and. But then, you know, after the first round of Ferguson, I was like, yeah, I think I need to go ahead and get an AR. And for a couple of reasons, you know, for any number of reasons. One, I honestly think with the AR-15 that I kind of had to call myself on my own BS because I actually think every house should have one. I think if you're a gun owner in the country that you should have an AR. I think it's like citizen duty. I think you should have one, and I think you should have
for political reasons or for
protection reasons. Yeah, no, for political reasons. Yeah. I think it's kind of that, and it's kind of a line in the sand kind of thing. Like you know that you should have that. You know, granted, if there was ever like a you know things went south and I had to park on my roof, I'm going to go up with my Sharps Buffalo rifle first. And just because I want to. So.
Because there aren't enough roof Koreans to cover everything.
That's exactly right. I'm telling you, that guy should have popped his collar. That'd have been awesome.
Be a roof PI.
That's right. Yeah, but, that's, you know, the
roof PI. And that's a great point because, you know, it used to be that mob violence in the U.S. was not a thing for the, you know,
right.
Really since. You know, even in the 60s, the mob violence right. was easily avoidable.
Right.
Now you are speaking, you are singing the song of my people.
What? Not that violence? Sort of mob.
Yeah. No. But these days, you know, we see more and more where.
Right.
It comes to you and then you have to, you know, you almost have to do like an escape and evasion kind of thing to get away from these things, these flash mobs of violent youths and things like that. And
Well, and I always think too of like, you know, what if someone, you know, what if you're involved in a bad scenario, whether it's a shooting or whatever, and someone docks your house, you know, they dock where your family lives all over the internet, you know, because you could literally wake up one morning and find 500 people outside your door because you got involved in a legit, a good shooting, but everyone else has, you know, politicized it. And suddenly you've got, you know,
or you just piss somebody off on Twitter or something. I mean,
that's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. Or you work for an organization that the governor of Connecticut calls a terrorist organization.
Yeah, that's yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Crazy.
It is crazy.
I was actually going to ask your opinion on a couple of things, since you are the novelty on the show here. First off, I want to know where the anti-robot thing came from.
Oh, that's just common sense.
Did that just sort of happen, or is there some deep-seated, you know, did a robot abuse you when you were a child? Or?
It touched me in a very bad place.
Did you fall into a light bright, Matthew?
No, it was a Teddy Ruxpin.
Oh, no. Oh, that would do it.
Yeah. Have you seen one of those without its fur?
Oh, right. Right.
Scary.
In fact, we were discussing cyborgs in the home the other day, and because May says, she goes, "Well, I didn't think you were afraid of anything," and I was like, "Well, cyborgs."
But I have
because
to mention,
robots are strong,
you know. Right? You know, it's like the rabidly anti-gay Republican who turns out to be a closet homosexual. Or the gun, the anti-gun liberal politician who turns out to be a gun runner. Are you in fact secretly a robot?
He is actually a T-1000.
That's what I'm wondering, you know?
I can other, you know. I did not have sexual relations with that one.
With that toaster.
Me and that toaster, right.
Just
funny enough, I have a story about a case with a guy. You say toaster, and I think an oven, because years ago I had this crazy case, and this woman, her husband, she walked into the kitchen, and she just said, she goes, he was fucking the oven.
What?
Right. I don't know. I never asked any more than that, and I just kind of raised my eyebrow. I was like, can you repeat that?
And how?
I don't know. I was like, I don't
need
know
a diagram. I don't know how that happens.
Everyone always says the same thing to me when I tell that story. Like, was the door open? I was like, I don't know.
Was
I don't
there
know.
An oven mitt involved?
Right. No, it apparently was just the oven. Like, he
was
driving up
on?
In the oven.
Oh.
I don't know. Yeah.
You know, they make jokes about, like, the washing machine on spin cycle, but I've never heard the oven before.
Well, the washing machine at least makes sense because it vibrates and moves. I don't really know what an oven does, so.
Yeah. Was it a gas stove or electric? I don't know.
Yeah. And she walked in on me in the middle of the night, and I was like, does your husband do drugs? And she's like... You know, I thought maybe it was a hot. She's apparently he was banging. Apparently, that's what drew her to the kitchen was the sound of the noise.
Oh my god!
Right,
someone is copulating with the Kenmore.
And now everyone who listens to this at some point is going to walk in the kitchen and be like, "I don't understand." They're going to look at the oven and be like, "Oh, there'll be the one guy."
Yeah. I was just going to say there's going to be that one guy that's looking at the oven going, "Hey, baby."
I never thought about that before.
How you doing?
That's right. Do I turn you on?
Oh, that's terrible.
I'm here all week.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
Alan, did you have more questions for Matthew?
I did have a sort of philosophical question. And this is something I I've been known to talk about at length, and I just wondered if I could pick Matthew's brain about, it's kind of a socio-political thing, and it has to do with robots, so it's right down his alley.
Okay.
You know, the whole employment situation in the U.S. is really having a problem. You know, we've gone through several cycles of this. You know, it used to be everybody worked on the farm, and now only 4% of the people work on the farm. And then everybody moved to factories, and then the factories went away. Now everybody's in service businesses, if they even bother to work, or they're on some sort of disability and sitting around and all that kind of stuff. And there's always, you know, there's all these schemes and things like that. Oh, yes, we're going to tax the wealthy, and we're going to give everybody a basic income, and, you know, because humans in mass numbers sitting around with idle with nothing to do is no cause for concern whatsoever.
Right.
And you know, we have this, you know, mob violence and stuff like that. You know, what, do you have any thoughts on that sort of thing? As far as, I don't know, however you want to couch it, personal protection or what to, you know, the danger signs of a incipient mob violence. You know, I don't know. Is that a concern?
I think I'm not smart enough to answer to have an answer. I think that's my concern.
Okay.
So you know what? I want to go back and actually answer your first question though, before, because I about whether or not, you know, I would, I'm a closet cyborg.
Oh.
yeah, I know. You're like, what was my question? So, as you're asking me that question, we bought a drone for work. And so, literally, about the time you asked me that, my business partner was like, well, can you pick up the drone? And I was like, I really don't want to pick up the drone. And so, as you're asking me that question, I'm sitting there looking at the table. I'm looking at this drone. I'm like, huh, how the hell do I answer this question? I was like, well, I can lie.
First a drone, and yeah. Then you're going to have two Roombas like Alan.
I saw a Roomba. I was in the hotel last week or 2 weeks ago, and I was coming out, and this thing comes rolling towards me, and I almost shot it. So
they are a little disturbing.
They're very kinda... well, especially when you step to the left and it follows you to the left. I was like, it's begun.
this is how it starts.
And I was like, and I'm not even home. I don't even have all my ammo with me. So,
oh shit! Yeah. Do you have the ammo failure dream?
Oh yeah. It used to be a real heavy trigger. You know, it was always for a long time. It was a real heavy trigger. That was the one thing.
That's an interesting twist. Yeah.
Like, but you pull me out, right? But it was, you know, you couldn't pull the trigger on it, or there was one where I was having to use a revolver, where I was having to use a Smith revolver in the dream, and I'm like, why is the thumb latch also a safety? What, that doesn't, when did they come up with this bullshit? And and then at some point, like, I hit it wrong and the cylinder came out, so it was all I've had the bullets literally, you know, fall off people.
It's funny because it seems like everybody that starts carrying a gun at some point, they start having that same kind of dream where it's like, you know, you're shooting somebody over and over and over again, and you know, either the bullets are passing through them with no effect, or they're hitting them and bouncing off, or they're just kind of going pew off the end of the barrel, and you could just sort of falling onto the ground, or you know.
Oh yeah, because they'll do that. I'm like, how is this? I'm hitting center mass. Why is this not doing anything? There was one. It was only like 3 years ago, and I had one. And like, I remember waking up because I was going pew 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 pew. And I was like, well, maybe if I say something, that'll help the bullets shoot harder.
Oh man.
Yeah.
It's the Wile E. Coyote method.
It's exactly right. Yeah, you know, I think to answer your second question, though, about, you know, I think that there – I think what you do see is, I think you're seeing a lack of physical labor and a lack – I think it's taking away a work ethic. where it's, you know, idleness is kind of becoming so prevalent. That, and you look at these kids who I'm like, they don't have, because there's nothing for them to do that's physically challenging, you know? And I think and these jobs are only going to get more so that way. You know, there's going to be they're going to go more cyborg on these jobs because, one, now you've increased the level of incompetency in people because no one knows how to work with stuff. And then on top of it, why would you pay a person and incur all the liability costs of getting, you know, hurt and injured on the job and everything else when you don't have to?
Cyborgs also don't file Me Too hashtags.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
You can harass the hell out of them.
Except for the oven.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that oven got Me Too'd, I'll tell you that much. I don't think he asked for that. Or she. I don't know how it identified.
I wonder how long before we start having the gender of the oven? I wonder how long before we start having the sex bot, like corporate robot crossover kind of thing.
I just like to say one thing about the sex robot. What the hell's wrong with people? I mean, really. I mean, what virgin came up with that?
A Japanese one, I believe.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. Maybe we shouldn't have dropped. Maybe dropping the bomb on them messed it up. I don't know.
On the other hand, women have been using sex robots for a long time.
Just saying. Micro robots.
Are those technically robots? Close.
I don't know, but now there's apps on your phone for them.
That's right.
Yeah. Yep. So I think we're getting into smart technology. I think you're, yeah.
Yeah, wait till that cyborg.
I saw a video where a woman's hooked up like what looked like a V8 engine, but.
Oh, wow. What was that link?
But see, yeah, here's where you're wrong. They don't make a V8 anymore like that, so. Well, not 350. So, yeah, or if it was electric.
Yeah, that's true. I think it was an EcoBoost.
It was an
EcoBoost. Oh man.
Oh.
Or was it the battery plant out of a Tesla hooked
up? There you go. No, because it would have caught fire.
Ah, nice. Yeah, that's a good point.
See, that right there, Matthew, that fits right into your whole cyborg thing. You make a car that runs on batteries alone, and it catches fire because it wants to kill you.
Because it wants. That's right. That's right.
Well, that Uber car ran right into somebody. The cops. I don't know if y'all heard the resolution of that, but they basically said the person like stepped out in front of the car, and even if it had been a human driver, they would have hit it.
But still, supposedly, you know what? You know why? You know why she got hit by that car? Because that car wanted to hit her. That's if she stepped up back on the curb in time, it'd chased her up there. It was going to chase her down and murder that woman. It probably had been running like, you know, AI social programming the entire time and had her profiled. Today's the day. That car is no different than the Austin bomber, just randomly going around killing people. They just stopped it early. That's all.
I did see a thing that said that doorstep package thefts had dropped off like crazy in Austin, like 93% or something.
That's, yeah.
What a way to solve that problem.
Yeah, it was funny because the night before they caught, I guess, you know, the hours before they caught him, I was up on we've been working this case sometimes when you work cases, you kind of have to, when you start investigating stuff, in my opinion, if you investigate stuff thoroughly, you have to kind of go about half crazy because you kind of have to really delve into stuff. And, so I was up the night before they caught until like 2 o'clock in the morning. I had sat down at like 5 and just started pulling strings on this case I'm working in. And literally that was my last thought before I went to bed. I was like, man, I really wish they would catch that Austin that bomber. Cause that's, I got pseudo in a training exercise, got killed by a bomb. You know, they were like, you've been blown up. And that kind of spooked me. And then back, maybe 10 years ago, I was in Karachi. And we were going to the airport, and Islamabad airport had been bombed that morning. And we were coming up to the airport, and a car bomb went off.
Yikes.
Yeah, and that was a whole nother experience in my life. And it was like around a corner. So I really didn't feel any kind of concussion off of it, you know, round windows and shit. But, you know, you see the plume of smoke, and I was like, huh? You know, give me a straight up gunfight. You know that. And what was bizarre about that is because like we almost didn't get out of Karachi because of me, so I had taken these two black duffel bags, and so we were going in to check our airport security, and I've never felt depression before. You know, I was telling a couple guys this at the gym last week, and like never felt like socially oppressed. You know, I'm a white guy, don't know it, and we. When we got into Pakistan, we were in the airport. I was like, "Oh, you can taste it. It's in the air. That's what that feels like." Mm-hmm. And I was it was a really bizarre feeling. So when we were leaving, everybody was on high alert because the bombing in Islamabad, and then clearly, you know, the bomb going off next to the airport had everyone kind of a race concern. And so we had dumped our bags, and I had these two exact matchy black duffel bags. And so they start sending them through the x-ray machine. And it's like, you know, it's not the TSA. It's, you know, the Pakistani guard. You know, they're standing there with berets and AKs. I see my one black bag come out, and then I see the other one go in. It starts to come out. I see just the front of it. And I was like, okay, cool. Because I've got, like, an external baton, and I've got my big knife. I had a CRK-2 Hisatsu fixed blade in there, and a couple other things. And all of a sudden, the bag goes backwards. Oops. And I'm like, oh, this is not good. And then it comes out, and then it goes backwards again. And then this guy with a beard but no mustache looks at me and just waves me over. And he's got his AK clutched to his chest. I'm like, well, here we go. And I looked at my client. I was like, whatever you do, you best get on that plane. He's like, well, I'm not leaving you. I was like, dude, there's going to be nothing you can do for me. I was like, is this, you know, this about the knife? And he's like, no one cares about the knife. Okay. And I was like, huh. He was like, what are these wires? And so he showed me on the screen. I had two-way radios that I'd taken with me. And I had taken chargers. And so they were all wrapped up, and they looked like IEDs.
Oh, wow.
Oh yeah, yeah. Whoops. And so I was like, so I said, you can open them up. He goes, you open them up. And I was like, touche. And so yeah, I turned them on and everything, and we were all cool after that. But I was, yeah, I was real happy to get out of Islam. I liked, like, we're in the outer country, and we're our host's fort, because that's what it was. There was a couple of the Taliban guys there. You could tell like they did not like us. But like, you know, they were as redneck as anybody else could be. We were shooting AKs off in the air and everything else. Because they said, I forgot, they said, you know, in America, this is how you celebrate. And in Pakistan, this is how we celebrate. And, you know, the guy fired an underfolder AK straight up in the air. And, yeah. I've never talked about this publicly. But I had a very, very interesting experience with a Tokarev pistol on that trip. So they gave me someone loaned me a Tokarev. And so we were out the range. I had a Tokarev and an AK. And we're out shooting. And one of the guys says, here, I want to show you something. He puts this magazine into the Tokarev. And he goes, here, squeeze the trigger. I was like, okay. And they had terrible, terrible trigger pull. And then all of a sudden it goes, blah! It shoots four rounds. It shoots four rounds off. I'm like, okay, this has got a bad sear or something. And so he pops the mag out and puts another mag in, and it shoots single shots. I said, load that other mag up. And so he loads the other mag up, and it shoots four rounds. I swap mags. I put the other one in. It shoots single shots. And so I get to look. I'm looking at the mags, and like four down on the round count in the magazine, there's a hole drilled in the front of the magazine, and there's something to do with the sear engagement on a Tokarev. Yep. Something. Yeah.
That's funny. But,
yeah.
Now I'm wondering. Oh, what the hell is it? Because there's two different variants of the ammo. One of them was a little hotter to run the PPSH?
Yeah.
I wonder if that's it. If it was loaded with the hotter ammo, which is driving the slide back faster.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Yeah, because it was – yeah, that's true. Yeah, because that was kind of their answer to like the old NATO 9mm ammo that was made for submachine guns. Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. That's exactly it. Just a little bit hotter to drive the bolt of, you know, like an Uzi or an MP5 as opposed to, you know, a handgun.
Right. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, because I know that's why they always talked about all the surplus Brownings that would come in. We're always beat to shit from these third world countries. Yep. It wasn't because they were badly taken care of. It was because everyone shot NATO ammo, submachine gun ammo out of them.
Whoops. Because they had it.
Yeah, that's right.
I also have it from a source I will not disclose that certain modern 9mm pistol carbines, if you use that ammo in it, will fire more than one round.
Really?
I've heard or anecdotally, if they're worn. Of course. What's that?
From the factory or if they're just worn?
If they're worn.
You just got to wear it just right.
Exactly. I've had an AR do that where it was worn.
Oh.
And start doubling.
That happened to a buddy of mine. He had messed with the trigger on his 10/22, and I just got him into shooting. Yeah. And we're at the range, and I was like, and he's shooting next to me. I was like, I swear to God, it sounds like he's shooting two rounds at a time. And I look over at him, and he's just kind of looking at me like, something's up.
I think it's broken.
Right. Broken in all the right but wrong ways.
You know when it's really bad to have that happen is when you're trying to accuracy test. I've heard.
Allegedly.
And, but that's fun. That's the thing, though.
You're getting 5-inch groups. What you the know, hell?
The ATF is notorious for, you know, coming up with ways to make a semi-automatic rifle go to full auto. But
all they have to do, all they would have to do if they really want to catch somebody, wait until 3 days before the magazine goes to print to test it. I guarantee you will find all kinds of interesting features, or at least that's what I've heard from other people who work other publications in other organizations.
Not yours.
I mean, any semi-auto, once the sear or whatever functions as a sear gets a little worn, it's going to start doubling at least. And sometimes it'll do a mag dump. It just, you know, depends on.
Oh, yeah.
That would be a surprise.
Trust me, it is. I've had it's it not a fun before. It's, you know, that's.
It's not a fun one.
No. It's.
Is it? The SKS, I believe, if you use like modern ammunition, the primers are a lot softer and the firing will just keep riding and just.
Right. Well, especially when the firing pin gets stuck because it gets gunked up.
Yep.
Yeah, because there's a guy down in Texas that he's kind of the SKS guy. And like he makes firing pins that are supposed to be more for modern ammunition. So I'll have to try some modern ammo with my SKS.
And of course, the M60 is notorious for running off for an entirely.
Oh, yeah. Reason.
Yes. Yeah, but that's at least supposed to be.
I don't know.
It's supposed to stop when you let go of the trigger.
Yeah. That is an awkward thing when that happens.
Always,
oopsie.
Yeah. Why machine guns fire from an open bolt? Because barrels get really hot.
That's, yeah.
All right. Well, we're about out of time.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on.
It was a good time.
A great talk.
It was good.
Yeah, awesome. It was.
Thanks for joining us.
We'd love to have you back because we didn't even get to talk about your, you know, being famous on TV thing.
That's
right.
So we'll have to have you back again sometime.
We'll have to have a part two episode.
Let's do it.
Hey, cool. Okay.
And we didn't even get to the three of us meathead up on Alan.
What? Oh, yeah. Well, Alan goes to the gym.
I lift.
He works, bro. Okay.
All right. Well, then we can all meet him.
That's right.
Jay just started lifting weights, so he's got like
I resumed lifting weights. Thank you very much.
Well, you have renewed your interest. Let's just say that, right?
It was only a pause of 26 years.
Man says take a break sometime.
Sometimes it's good to take a break. Yeah.
Took a break. Yep.
A week, two weeks. Couple decades.
Couple decades. Yep.
Well, you got to let your muscles rest.
Exactly. Rusty is very important. Rebuild.
It was an extended rebuilding period.
Well, we'll be back next week, and we actually have a guest lined up.
Yep. Next week. Should we leave it as a surprise?
No, let's just say who it is.
Okay, go ahead.
It is Martin Wilsey. Some of y'all have know who he is.
Famous author.
Yeah, he worked for a three-letter agency for a long time, and now he is retired and parlayed his self-publishing empire into a source of income. So
he drinks coffee and makes stuff up.
Yeah. We're gonna be talking to him next week.
That'll be fun. Good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again, Matthew.
Yeah. And, thanks for having me on. No, it was a great time.
Everybody have a great week. We'll talk to you later. Bye. All right.
Bye.
Night, y'all.